Dr. Kincaid is a native Floridian, and he started out diving in the caves in Wekiva Springs. So he was one of those kids that held his breath and went down through the cracks to see how far he could go. That kind of daredevil attitude led him to a bachelor's and a master's in geology and hydrogeology, and also a PhD in hydrogeology. He's been all over the world, Turkey, China, Mexico, diving in underwater caves. He is an expert in hydrology. He's done diatrace studies, particularly in Wakulla Springs. Dr. Kincaid has flown in from Nevada to talk about how long does it take for that water to go from Water Conserve to Wekiwa Springs? How long does it take for water to travel underground? He says every time a municipality says, oh, it takes decades for water to go from point A to point B, as in Wekiwa Springs, it turned out to take 66 days. Point of the talk here is nothing more than let's find out how long it takes the water to get there and where it goes. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Todd Kincaid.
Thanks, Chuck. It wasn't too long before I was making about 4 cave dives a week, and I did that all the way through my college career at the University of Florida. We went to all kinds of springs. I mean, Volusia Blue, of course, is, you know, one of the close ones. Crystal River, Juniper, Jenny, Madison Blue, Jackson Blue, Peacock, Manatee, Royal, Bathtub, Cal, Troy, Itchituckney, Blue Hole, Little River, Wakulla. Chasing further and further back into the caves. Devil's Ear, my home turf when I went up to University of Florida. Devil's Ear is on the Santa Fe River right outside of Ginny Springs. I was lucky to explore the back reaches of Madison to about a mile and a half. Ultimately, my partner and I set the North American record for the longest cave dive in North America, obviously, at 2 miles in Manatee Springs. A former friend and colleague of mine, Wes Skiles, was one of the active explorers at the time exploring the Wakulla cave system. His real passion, though, was to take video cameras with him and to capture that on film, and he became widely known as one of the most accomplished underwater cinematographers in the world. He made a documentary called Water's Journey, and if you haven't seen that documentary, I highly recommend it. You can order it on Amazon.com. I wish that Wes could continue to be with us today, but that, alas, he's not here any longer. Somewhere about that time, I stumbled into a geology course at the University of Florida as an undergraduate, and I learned about groundwater. I decided to change my major away from civil engineering and dedicate my career to studying groundwater science. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to try to tell you a little bit about what I've learned. So the first thing I learned when I got to a hydrogeology class was that there are no such thing as underground rivers. I learned that groundwater flow is a diffuse and slow process. I learned that velocities tend to be on the order of feet per year, or sometimes even less. And I learned that the mathematical concepts that we were taught, they evolved out of a sandstone aquifer, the great sandstone aquifer of the Midwest, the Ogallala Aquifer. They didn't sit really well with me, given that 4 days a week I was diving in these caves and feeling flow blowing so fast that if I stopped kicking, it would shoot me out the other end at a rate quite a bit faster than feet per year, I can assure you. But some other things that I learned that did really resonate is that water flows down gradient no matter where you are, no matter what rock you're in. Inflows always equal outflows. But then in terms of the hydrologic cycle, This is sort of the concept that we're taught, is that you have rain that infiltrates the ground, and the infiltration accumulates in the aquifer, and then the water flows through this diffuse process on its path to rivers and streams and ultimately the ocean. And that the aquifer itself, even though groundwater flows very slowly, can have an enormous amount of storage. This, however, is a little bit more close to how I saw it. Water still flows down gradient, even in karst. Inflows still equal outflows, but groundwater is a fast, convergent flow process. And that's what all of this really boils down to, is a model of how we think the world works. In the karst system, groundwater flows really fast, and there's a lot less storage. So there's a lot less water in the aquifer, and it moves through the aquifer a hell of a lot faster. Okay, so here's what the difference is between these two models. And the diffuse flow model, basically what it says is groundwater flows diffusely, meaning evenly and slowly through the aquifer, and it converges onto the river, and that the river gains 100 CFS upstream and 200 CFS downstream. So it picks up 100 CFS. It's a gaining stream from the groundwater discharge. And that gain is occurring all along, evenly across the reach of the river. Of course, if you spend any time on Florida rivers, you realize that that's not really what it looks like, right? You paddle along the river, and then you see a spring. And so it might gain exactly that 100 CFS, but instead of it gaining it evenly across the reach of the river, it gains it at, in this case, two discrete points at the two springs. And you can see the pickup, you know, with your own eyes as you paddle down the river. And the difference here is that this one, there must be convergent flow in order for this to be true. There must be conduits that connect to those springs. And those conduits must collect water from an upland recharge area and then convey it to the springs. If I rendered this in three dimensions, this is just a hypothetical image here. We have a conduit. This block represents the water table, or represents the aquifer, the part of the aquifer that's got water in it. And what the conduits do is they create troughs like canyons. How many people have ever, you know, hiked through a canyon? All the water drains into the canyon, and then the canyon picks up the water and delivers it out the other end. And that's exactly what's happening in the aquifer because of these conduits. Now, really, as a scientist or as an engineer, our challenge is to take these models of the world and then do something useful with them, right? To be able to make predictions or to help guide people in their decision-making processes. Well, we use math to do that. Now, you ever hear the joke about losing your glasses, and the man's looking on the ground for his glasses, and the other person comes up and says, "You lost your glasses. Where'd you lose them?" "Oh, I lost them in the other room." I'm like, "Well, why are you looking in this room?" "Because it's light in this room. It's dark in the other room. I can't see." Well, that's kind of where we're at. Basically, in the early 1970s, as we started to evolve in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, all the way into the 70s, as we started to evolve our knowledge of groundwater flow systems, both karst and porous media, the limitations on our ability to compute the mathematics behind them drove us to this model out of necessity. But for the last 20 years, we have not been here as a form of necessity. We can quite readily, and there is a software available right off the shelf to help us deal with the model of conduits. But what I'm going to talk about is the consequence of us being firmly rooted in the assumption that the Floridan aquifer is this porous media, this sand model. Next. This is what the Floridan aquifer looks like. There is differences in the aquifer. This map shows the confinement in the Floridan aquifer. This region in the lightest area we call the karst belt, where the aquifer is unconfined. So basically it means that there's literally nothing that impedes recharge from occurring directly to the Floridan aquifer anywhere where this light area is occurring. And all these black dots are first magnitude springs, meaning that they discharge more than 100 CFS. And all these white dots are second magnitude springs, which means they discharge somewhere between 10 and 100 CFS. And you can see that the concentration of these is pretty highly favored into the unconfined region. But it's not all in the unconfined region. All of these springs are discharges from the Floridan. The darker areas are where the Floridan becomes progressively covered by thicker and thicker amounts of confining material. And what that confining material does is it impedes recharge. So you can pretty easily look on a map and you can think about where you are today. The fact that there are all these streams and lakes and everything else in the Orlando region is only because you're on the confined material. Because the water, it doesn't recharge rapidly through that material and get into the Floridan aquifer. That's what the confinement does. So there's three areas that I'm going to kind of refer to today. Most of the time I'm going to talk about the Wakulla Springs area, which is up here in the Big Bend, south of Tallahassee. I've been studying the Wakulla area for probably 13 years with the Florida Geological Survey. We chose Wakulla for a specific reason. The idea is that the great thing about science is that if you can understand processes, then those processes become more broadly applicable to other regions, right? So instead of studying individual things all over the state, we decided to focus intently on one area so that we could identify how it works, identify methodologies that are useful for the characterization of that type of hydrogeologic environment, the karst hydrogeologic environment in Florida. Okay, so this is Wakulla. It's a big spring, 120 to 1500 CFS, depending on what day you measure it. So that's somewhere between, on average, 250 million gallons a day, and it peaks out at over a billion gallons of water per day creates the headwaters of the Wakulla River. This is these are caves from the Wakulla cave system. Those are divers. Yep, so now they're entering into the cave system, and this will give you a little sense of what the caves look like. I'm not here to tell you that Wakaiva is like Wakulla. Wakulla is the longest underwater cave in North America. It is some of the largest underwater cave passages that have been observed anywhere in the world. But what I will tell you is that the processes are the same in terms of the capacity of those conduits to transmit water relative to the capacity of the rock around it to transmit flow. When I was an undergraduate, I, of course, was diving every day, and they were teaching us that there's no such thing as underground rivers. My professor, Dan Spangler, invited Wes Skiles to come to our classroom. I didn't admit to many of people at University of Florida that I was a cave diver, so I kind of tried to keep that under wraps. When Wes came, he showed videos of the caves that I was diving in, and everybody was really impressed and blown away. And Dr. Spangler appropriately pointed out that karst was described in our textbook. It accounted for the one paragraph of the one chapter in our textbook that said, basically, that everything else in this textbook is not relevant to karst environments. That was the one paragraph on karst. A little while after that, one of the professionals from Suwannee River Water Management District also came to our class. Basically, he came and he was telling us about how all of these methodologies, you know, are duly applied in the management of groundwater resources. And one of the questions was, well, how do you deal with karst and the presence of caves in the Suwannee River Basin? And he said, well, caves really don't exist. The student said, well, we just saw the video from Wes Skiles. And he said, Wes Skiles fabricated all of that stuff. They really don't exist. Or if they do exist, they're just anomalies that are irrelevant. So in other words, you don't have to worry about them. Just continue to focus on the porous media theory that you're being taught and everything will be fine. To me, I think that's largely why we are where we are today. So this is now Wakulla, unfortunately, pretty overgrown with algae and a massive hydrilla problem. Any spring you go to, you see that you have early levels where nitrates are really low, and then as you move into the more recent decades, nitrates are up. In this case at Wakulla, they peaked out at above 1 and started to stabilize somewhere between 0.8 and 1 milligram per liter. Lots of studies identifying sources, septic systems, wastewater treatment, fertilizers, industry. The question was, what is the hydrogeology? What do we know about the system so that we can narrow down those sources and we can identify the bad guy? Here's what was known about the Woodville Karst Plain where the Wakulla sits in and around 1990. These blue lines here were the mapped caves that had been mapped by the Woodville Karst Plain Project divers. This is the small Wakulla cave system as it was mapped in and about 1990. All these brown lines are rivers that disappear at places that we call swalettes, where they go completely underground. This is the Munson Slough that takes about 60% of the city of Tallahassee's stormwater, comes through Lake Munson, and then ultimately goes underground here at these swalettes called Ames Sink. And over here, this is where the city of Tallahassee spray field is located. Water always flows down gradient, and flow is converging from the north, from the west, from the east, and it's flowing into this big trough here that is called the Woodville Karst Plain. This is where all of these springs are located, and then ultimately flows out the Wakulla River to the Gulf of Mexico. Wakulla Springs, the third largest spring in the state, like I said, an average discharge about 250 million gallons a day. Spring Creek, formerly listed in the books as the largest spring in Florida, probably a comparable discharge, but people estimated that it might be twice or three times more flow as Wakulla. And then St. Marks River Rise, again, a comparable discharge to Wakulla in terms of magnitude. So you have these three major spring discharges, you know, emitting rivers of water into the Gulf. And then, of course, all these other stars are second magnitude springs, some comparable to Wakaiva, most of them quite a bit smaller. What we also knew is that we had done age dating studies that had labeled the Wakulla Springs water at being 40 years old. Right there, that was a key point of scientific data. Sprayfield went in about 1980, and this was about 2000 when we were having this discussion. The water at Wakulla Springs is 40 years old. So what's the conclusion? If the water's 40 years old, how can the nitrate at Wakulla possibly be coming from the spray field? Because the nitrate at Wakulla must ergo too be at least 40 years old, right? So we have these age dates. We have groundwater models that suggest that flow is around 0.1 to at most 25 feet per day. So again, you look at it, this distance is 12 miles, 0.1 feet per day. Gives you an idea that the spray field is a really long way away. It's not a high source of water. Now, note one thing. These lines are what we call the potentiometric surface, and they essentially, the lines on the outside are the high lines. So this is the canyon that I showed you in that earlier image, okay? And this is the flanks of the canyon. All the water is flowing in. If you look at the potentiometric surface, the spray field is here. The gradient is here. So there is a pathway, and that was duly noted by the Northwest Florida Water Management District. But nonetheless, what people keyed into was the 40-year age, the travel times. And so the dominant thinking at the time was that the nitrate at the spray field was going to St. Mark's, not to Wakulla. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through a series of scientific investigations that we did, groundwater tracing experiments that we did in the basin, to try to better understand the flow paths to Wakulla Springs, to maybe learn more than what we could learn simply from the age dates and the potentiometric surface maps. So we like to key into things like groundwater tracing. It's pretty idiot-proof. You put something in the water, and then you go, and if you find it someplace else, woo, I've got a connection, and I can measure the distance. Well, the powers that be didn't want to hear anything about tracing work. We didn't want to hear anything about tracing to Wakulla Springs because it was believed it would be impossible because Wakulla was too big of a flow. In other words, if you put some dye in the ground, it's going to be so diluted with the flow at Wakulla Springs that you're never going to see it. By the way, a dye tracer test had been done maybe 20 years ago where they put some dye in at Ames Sink, the sink that takes the discharge water from the city of Tallahassee, and they didn't see it at any of the wells that they tested around there. I wanted to point out that they didn't bother to look at Wakulla Springs, but nonetheless, nobody looked, so they didn't find, the tracer test didn't work, and nobody was paying attention to this suspicious thing that looks like an underground river. So we wanted to go in and just do some tracing. So the very first trace that we did, I proposed, well, we're going to put some dye into one sinkhole, and we're going to measure it at another one. And I was pretty sure it would get there because I'd already swam that distance, okay? So I loaded that shotgun to make sure that I would win a successful trace. It was Sullivan Sink to Sherrill Sink, 1.6 miles, traveled 8,800 feet per day. And I said, oh, wow, look, we're successful there. We might as well go over here to Fisher Creek and maybe we can see where it goes. And lo and behold, Fisher Creek 2 travels 3,700 feet per day. We did it at Black Creek, same thing, about 2,600 feet per day. And this one was interesting. At Black Creek, we put some extra sampling stations further down in the cave system, and we saw, hey, this little bit of dye that we put at Black Creek keeps on going, and it heads suspiciously toward Wakulla Springs. And we could track it all along its path. The other thing that we learned is at the same time we were doing a collaborative study with some age daters, and I asked them to age date Sherrill Sink, and the age date came back at 35 years. So not wanting to be too much of a smartass, I said, okay, well, if the travel time is what we get from the tracer test, and presuming that this is a continuous process, you know, with a porous media aquifer, then this water must be coming from 21,000 miles away. Because you told me how old it is, and I'm telling you how fast it's going, and the only way to rectify those two is to tell you that it came from right about here, but instead of coming here directly, it went around the world. With that one, I was actually able to get some more funding to do another trace. By 2005, the divers in the Woodville Carse Plain Project had done a lot more diving. They really explored a lot of cave in Wakulla. So now Wakulla is it. So you're talking about many miles of mapped cave passage by this time. We're going to do some more tracing. We injected at the same point in the cave system where we got the detection from Black Creek and Fisher Creek, and we tracked it all the way through this cave through many sinkholes. We had drilled a well into Wakulla, and we saw it come out at Wakulla. So we know it came into the cave system down here and then turned and flowed north back up to the spring. The bottom line is it traveled 10.3 miles, 7 days. The velocity there is over a mile and a half per day. with this one in mind, they asked us finally to say, okay, why don't you guys trace aim sink? This is 60% of the city of Tallahassee stormwater runoff. Let's go ahead and trace it. We did one of the sinkholes, Kelly Sink, traveled to Indian Springs, 5.2 miles, 13 days, about 2,000 feet per day. The next one we did from Ames Sink itself to Indian Spring as well, 5.2 miles, 17 days, 1,600 feet per day. So we went ahead and did a trace from Indian, saw that it connected into the Leon Sinks cave system and then flowed down, makes the loop to Wakulla, and we get 5.5 miles, 5.9 days, about 5,000 feet per day. So the bottom line is whatever goes into Ames Sink is going to show up at Wakulla Springs approximately 2 weeks later. That's the takeaway message. Whatever is on Tallahassee streets, you're swimming in at Wakulla 2 weeks after that. So the big question then became pretty quickly, wow, if you guys can do all this with dye tracing, what about the spray field? The spray field is up on the margin of the confining unit. This is the city's treated wastewater effluent. So it goes through goes through secondary treatment, and so now it is 8 to 10 milligrams per liter nitrate at this point. Spray field was chosen, of course, for high infiltration rates, so it's real close to that edge. But there are no mapped conduits. No matter how many holes my friends climbed into, sinkholes out here, they couldn't find any caves going, you know, towards the spray field. Instead of tracing through known caves or from known swalettes, we're going to be tracing from the spray field. But the purpose is, of course, to say, does it go to Wakulla? Does it go to St. Mark's? This is what the spray field looks like. Two things to point out. These are the ones that we talk about because we're hydrogeologists. There's all this water flowing onto the ground, and it's infiltrating quickly. These plants aren't taking it up fast enough. Of course, they actually found out the spray field that they had to add fertilizer in order to grow anything because the infiltration rate was just too high. So they added fertilizer. They added cows to try to make this an economically viable farm, basically, was what their goal was. And what they found was that the 8 to 10 milligram per liter nitrate in the effluent was not enough fertilizer to sustain an economical crop. So they had to then augment that with additional fertilizer in order to grow anything at the spray field. This is what dye tracing looks like. Basically, you get a whole bunch of, you know, I call it the witch's brew. You put your hand in this, it will turn color. You just take all these pails, you pour them in that stream, or you pour them in the bucket, you pour it down the well. The witch's brew technically is drinkable, although I never had the guts to drink it, but it is listed as a harmless substance, and it is, you know, a food-grade dye that's used in all kinds of stuff. And we sampled between 4 months and 14 months. We sample it with these in situ devices that are measuring the fluorescence of the water, the optical fluorescence in the water. That's what they're measuring. So this is kind of what it looked like. The red flags are our automatic water samplers. We have samplers distributed all throughout this basin, heavily sampling here at Wakulla, Indian, McBride's. Over here at the St. Mark's River Rise, we got a well here. This is on St. Joe's property. These are USGS well. This is two USGS wells. We just, you know, concluded that, oh, well, wherever the nitrate's the highest, that's where the water from the spray field's going. So that's where we're going to sample. So we sampled all of these wells. The little blue lines are grab sampling that we were collecting either daily or once every couple of days manually. We're sampling all along the downstream edge of the spray field. These yellow arrows are where we injected. So we injected 20 kilograms of green dye in each one of these three wells, and we injected 60 kilograms of orange dye in this turf pond swalette. The first test, we injected a red dye, about 5 kilograms in each one of these wells. So we got red, green, and orange dye. Next slide. January 26, we injected 15 kilograms of red dye. Next, March 9 of the same year, we came back and injected 20 kilograms per well in the same wells. On that same day, we injected 60 kilograms of the orange. Next. So we got one and only one dye detection in SE10 along the entire front of the spray field. And we detected all three dyes in that one well. So we detected the red from the first, the green from the second, and the orange from the third injection. So the flow path is obviously this way here, but from the orange, it's coming way over and flowing that way. SJ1 and 2, we got all three dyes, and down here at SJ7, we only got the green and the orange for some reason. Next. We collected a whole lot of samples. We got a lot of positive detections. And this is the distribution of where they look like. So we got X's here means no detection. We got detection at SE10. That was our presumed pathway. Comes through. We collect. We measured them at SJ1 and 2, and then we drew these lines to show that we got positive detections at Indian, at Sally Ward, at Wakulla. And we got no detections anywhere over here on the St. Marks River or down here at Newport. Next. This is a different presentation of the data. This is called the breakthrough curve. What we saw is that when you have background concentrations of the dye, or essentially non-detect levels of the dye, and then as the plume comes through your sampling point, it rises to a peak concentration, plateaus for a little bit, and then comes back down afterward. So you can actually learn a tremendous amount about the aquifer behavior by analyzing these breakthrough curves and what their shapes look like. I'm not going to take you through all of that we can learn today, but I will show you something about the timing. Next. Remember, I had two injections, an early one and a late one. Next. This is the second injection. And this is the recovery curves at the wells close to the spray field. These are the USGS wells close to the spray field. Next. And this was the first injection. And over here I have days, the days after injection. So what's interesting is they're close together, but the second one appears to have traveled faster than the first one. But then we saw it again down here at Wakulla, going green, red. And this time the gap is bigger, as you might expect, because the distance was a lot further, but the green dye clearly traveled faster than the red dye. So we're like, wow, why is that? Now let's think about that a little bit more in depth. And what we see is that it's related to the water levels in the aquifer. Where we injected the red dye, water levels were low. And right after we injected, we got a big series of rainstorms and a lot of recharge to the aquifer, and water levels shot way up in the aquifer. And when they shot way up, that swalette, that turf pond sink, started flowing. So another way to think of it, here was a dry period, the river, turf pond, was not taking any water. There was no water going into the swalette. Back in March, we had gotten that big rainstorm. Turf pond was just pouring water into the swalette. So that's when we put our dye in with it. We did the second injection here. And shortly after we did our injection, it stopped raining. The valve turns off and all the water levels drop way back down to their low, dry conditions. Okay, next. This is a hypothetical schematic showing turf pond, the conduit that goes out to Wakulla Springs, and these lines are the potentiometric surface in the Florida aquifer showing the flow directions relative to the conduit. So under low water conditions, the conduit is the trough. It's taking all the water, and all the water from the surrounding aquifer is feeding into the conduit, and then the conduit, it picks up velocity in the conduit, and it speeds along its way to the spring. When you have some kind of mechanism that creates high flow into the conduit, like let's, for instance, turf pond starts taking water, the conduit charges. It becomes pressurized. And once it becomes pressurized, this water can't get into it any longer because it's got too much pressure in the conduit. And so all of a sudden, this water, it can't go into the conduit, so it slows down, it changes direction, it just stagnates for a while until the dry period returns, the conduit drains, and now the pressure drains out of the conduit, and then flow can return, and everything moves quickly. Next slide. If we use tracing, our velocities come out between 252 and 2,337 meters per day, basically from about 750 feet per day to over a mile per day are the velocities that were defined by tracing. What are the assumptions relative to that method? Pumping tests. If we calculate velocities based on pumping tests, transmissivities, we get 0.03 to 0.23 meters per day. This is based on a gradient and aquifer thickness about 100 meters. And there's the reference for it. If we look at model-derived transmissivities, we've got 0.03 to 1.17 meters per day. Again, a calculated hydraulic gradient and the aquifer thickness of about 100 meters per day. And geochemical age date, if we do that, we come out with somewhere between 7.5 and 15 meters per day. That's based on an age of, we'll call it, between 20 and 40 years, assuming that 100% of the recharge is derived from a single source at the top of the basin. So what you can see is that unless you do the tracing, unless you pay attention to the conduits, you underestimate the travel time through the aquifer by orders of magnitude, multiples of 10. Next slide. By the time we got to this point, after 2008, this is now what the Leon Sinks Wakulla Cave System looks like. And the divers of my friends have been super active in the whole basin, explored cave up here at Bird Sink, Natural Bridge, and the Punch Bowl Sink over here, Shepherd Spring. We got cave explored down here at Spring Creek. And these are the totals. You have over 250,000 feet of mapped cave passages, 75,000 map meters of caves throughout this basin. Now, you might say, oh, this is Wakulla, it's unique. Oh, the big caves. And just because it's Wakulla, they're big, they're easy, they're accessible, the processes are the same. It's the same rocks, subject to the same gradients, the same types of recharge, the same thing, same, everywhere you go from Tallahassee all the way to Tampa, all the way through the Mid-Peninsula and all the way around. It's the same processes. So now I'm going to take you to another trace, a little, I think, much more consequential trace. This one was super consequential for whatever engineering firm that got that contract, but for us, thinking about the Floridan aquifer as a resource that for which we depend direly on, I think this trace is much more significant. We wanted to see what's the relationship between Spring Creek and Wakulla. Why did we sample 14 months when we did the trace? Well, because somebody had a vested interest in the possibility that Wakulla might not be the only destination of that water. I won't label who that was, but they came up with enough money to keep us sampling for 14 months. We didn't find any of the dye that we injected at either of those locations. But what we did see, because we bothered to look, we hadn't been looking, nobody had been looking prior to this, is that every summer since 2006, Spring Creek started to reverse flow. So the largest spring in the state of Florida, some people argue twice as much discharge as Wakulla, shuts off, and then it reverses flow for periods of a month or more during the summers of during Florida summer since 2006. That became significant, and we really wanted to figure out what was going on. So we decided to try to source the water for Spring Creek through tracing. And here we're going to focus on Lost Creek. Basically, what we did is we came in and we injected dye. So when we injected dye at Lost Creek, Spring Creek was flowing. But 5 days later, Spring Creek reversed. And we just got super lucky because essentially we got dye come out at Spring Creek. It came out in about 5 days. It came out for about 1 day before it stopped because Spring Creek stopped and started reversing. About 40 days later, we got dye at Wakulla Springs. So that dye plume that went into the ground split. It went to Spring Creek. Part of it probably hung out down here because it got trapped. The rest of it was subject to that reversal. And then it flipped off and it flowed north to Wakulla Springs. So what that did is it definitively showed that Wakulla and Spring Creek are connected by a conduit. Okay, and now my buddies are extremely motivated, and I am extraordinarily confident that one day a human being will swim from Wakulla Springs to Spring Creek. I've swam myself about 500 feet from Spring Creek north, and the tunnel is huge and just keeps on going north. But somebody, by the way, at this point, they connected Leon Sinks and Wakulla Springs is the longest cave in North America. They swam from Turner Sink 7 miles along this passage, and they came out at Wakulla Springs. So this trace was super consequential because it told us that these things were connected. And so we wanted to look into this more. Go to the next. Right about this time, we're talking about minimum flows and levels. Anybody familiar with minimum flows and levels? I have a feeling you are. This green line is the Wakulla discharge curve. And since about 2006, every time we move into the dry summer periods, the green discharge curve jumps up. And it actually gains flow in the dry part of the year. So the management district jumps to the great conclusion that why should we be concerned about flow at Wakulla Springs? There's actually a surplus. Every time we move into drought, magically, Wakulla gets more water. And I'm sitting here going, well, wait a second, guys. You lose the biggest spring in the state of Florida, you know, because of that. There's a relationship. Because the water that used to go to Spring Creek, of course, when Spring Creek shuts down, it flips and it goes to Wakulla Springs. That's what the dye trace showed. So that's why you see these jumps. So every time you see a jump in Wakulla, it's because Spring Creek is shut down. Go on to the next slide. This is the point that I want to make. Remember I showed you Punch Bowl Sink? It was a sinkhole about 3 miles inland from the Gulf of Mexico coast. At 3 miles inland, this is what we observe happening. is that whenever Spring Creek shuts down, water level at Punch Bowl jumps up, and so does the salinity. Salinity at Punch Bowl at depth, measured at about 300 feet in the conduit, jumps up to seawater conditions. So essentially, what we know definitively, go to the next slide, is that whenever Spring Creek reverses, salt water travels 3 miles through the aquifer and arrives at Punch Bowl sink in as little as 1 to 2 days. When you think about the implications here, it's huge. Okay, so why is this happening? Well, it couldn't be happening because of pumping, could it? Let's take a look. In reality, it's happening because the hydraulic gradient is getting flatter, right? That slope of that canyon that's driving water to Spring Creek is getting really flat. And it's flattening for two reasons. Sea level is going up. We know that sea level is going up. But also because we're pulling water out of the aquifer. So we're pulling it down on the top and we're pushing it up a little bit on the bottom. And as a consequence, what's happening is the springs along the coast, not just Spring Creek, Weekiwachee, all of the coastal springs are behaving the same way. They're shutting down their flow as the gradient flattens and the pumping is a part of it. We presume the Wakulla Spring Creek spring shed to be about half of this red line. Within that red line, there's 93 million gallons a day being pumped out in Georgia, and there's 21 million gallons a day being pumped out in Florida for agricultural use. So that's about 110 million gallons a day. Pump Wakulla's average discharge is 250 million gallons a day. Next. For municipal supply, we got about 54 million gallons a day and 24. So you're looking at 80 million gallons a day being extracted. That's Wakulla's base flow. It's being extracted for municipal use within that red line. So this is the relationship. So now let's take a quick look, difference between porous media and the karst methodology. What I want to do now is I want to jump into the central part of Florida and show this is a model. This colored map is the output from a numerical groundwater model simulation. This shows you where the model deviates from observed conditions. That's a nice way of saying it's in error. By the red boxes are more than 10 and 20 feet. The red stars are between more than 20 feet. The red pluses are 3 to 5 feet. And the blue circles are 5 to 10 feet. The model is in error by more than 3 feet at about 50% of the wells throughout the model domain, which is the central part of the Suwannee River and Santa Fe River Basin. It's in error by more than 5 feet at 25%, in error by more than 10 feet at 10%. It's error by more than 20 feet at 2% of the wells. Next. This is the kind of consequence. What this base map is a numerical model simulation of travel time. They've contoured the model's output such that you can see the predicted 100-year time of travel in the light blue, the 10-year time of travel in the medium blue, and the 2-year time of travel in the dark blue. In 2011, a colleague of mine did a series of dye traces in this region, and they injected a dye here in the 10-year time of travel zone. It traveled in about 294 to 311 days, 5 miles. It cut out of the 10-year through the 2-year and to the springs in less than a year. This one is outside of the 100. It's in the spring shed. It's in the model-defined 1,000-year time of travel zone. And it traveled across the 100 and into the 10 to a well in the 10. It took 181 to 194 days. So basically, again, what we're seeing is that those model-defined travel times are missing the mark by orders of magnitude. And this is really consequential because, correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, right now we're dealing with a BMAP process that uses travel time as the basis for vulnerability, an understanding of vulnerability of the springs. This is a model that we were able to build. We actually built this model for Coca-Cola in the Santa Fe River Basin. Real quick, why does Coca-Cola want to build numerical groundwater models, right? They own a spring water bottling plant right next to Ginny Springs. And as it turns out, Coca-Cola has conducted statistical risk assessments for every one of their water-producing operations, not spring water, but any Coca-Cola, Gatorade, all over the world. High Springs rose to the top of that risk assessment because of the fact that they felt that the nitrate levels were going to go up, for which they can't treat and maintain it as spring water. They thought that consumption was going to go up, which would threaten their ability to have access to water. And they felt that the methodologies being used by the management entities in this basin were not sufficient to adequately manage the resource because they didn't include karst. So we got the great opportunity to work for 4 years on Koch with the one mandate, build a better mousetrap. And so we went to the shelf of software and we chose a different piece of software and we used the technologies that have come out since the 1970s and we built a model that did just that. It includes conduits. These are the residuals. And you have less than a foot at more than 50% of the wells, less than 3 feet at more than 90% of the wells. It's there are three wells that deviate by more than 5 feet and only one well that deviates by more than 10. So here's what I want to say. With the porous media approach, the bottom line is that vulnerability is predicated on the distance between the resource and the source of contamination. It's a simple distance formula. If your well is closer to the coast, is closer to the ocean, then my well is closer to the ocean than his well, my well will get salty before his well as a consequence of saltwater intrusion. If your source of contamination is closer to the spring than his source of contamination, your source will get to the spring faster than his because it's a simple distance relationship. To understand which municipalities, vis-a-vis which wastewater treatment facilities, are most likely to be a threat to Coca-Cola's water bottling facility, which is right here next to Ginny Springs, right on the Santa Fe River. So what we did is we seed these municipalities with particles, and then we tell the model, tell me where the particle goes and track its path. And basically, what you see is that as soon as a particle gets into a conduit, boom, it goes to the spring. It doesn't matter. Notice that, you know, particles that are real close here, this is the high springs where Koch was most interested in, takes, there's 1,000, there's 10,000 days. So it takes almost 10 to the 5 days before it gets to the river because there's no conduits over there. It's moving through the porous media. On the flip side, bottom line is that Ginny Springs and Coca-Cola bottling operation are far more vulnerable to things that happen 12 and 20 miles away than they are to things that happen 1 and 5 miles away. Because it's not the distance to the spring, it's the distance to the conduit. How many people have heard about Cedar Key and the water supply wells at Cedar Key? Just recently, what happened there? They got salty. We can't drink salt water. You know what was really fascinating about, there's two things to me fascinating about Cedar Key. Number one, it was not predicted, and it's well within model domains. And number two, it happened overnight. It's not the distance to the coast, it's the distance to the conduit. And so if you've got a water supply well that's 10 miles inland, if it happens to be close to a conduit, if there are water supply wells close to the conduit that feeds water to Weekiwachee Springs, when Weekiwachee flips, those wells are subject to going under and reversing because of the proximity to that conduit. Next slide. I don't know what's happening at Wekiva, but I have no reason to believe that the processes here are substantively different than the processes anywhere else. You're absolutely right. The recharge to the Floridan, it is on the confining unit. But from what I can tell by reading the reports, the entities and the scientists that have studied it acknowledge that loading to the Floridan is fast. Once the water in the Floridan comes in, I doubt very sincerely that it's a 105-year travel time through the aquifer. Because every time we look, every time we trace, every time we do any of this stuff in the Floridan aquifer, we find that the models and the age dates used to predict those travel times are off by orders of magnitude. I know for a fact that there's a conduit at Wekiva. I remember it. I can tell you as a hydrogeologist that it's nowhere near the same kind of system as Wakulla. We don't see the big troughs. But what I can say as from my professional career, and I believe, is that you cannot rule out sources of contamination within the basin simply on the basis of distance. In the end of the day, if you go back to the pie chart that Bob showed, there's a distribution of sources of contaminants. And if you want a clean Wekiva Springs, you're going to ultimately have to deal with every one of those. So if you pick off one that says this is 20% of the problem, you focus all your energy into the 40% of the problem or the 50% of the problem, it's unlikely that it's going to fix the problem unless you deal with the rest of them. So if I can convey anything to you here, is that you cannot use the distance as the basis for vulnerability. What I would also point out is that water always flows down gradient. Doesn't matter what environment it is. if it's in the spring shed, it's a source and you're going to have to deal with it sooner or later. Karst is prevalent in Florida. Springs are fed by conduits. Every single spring is fed by a conduit. It might not be big enough to drive scooters through and make great videos of, but it's fed by a conduit. There really are such things as underground rivers. Vulnerability is not necessarily directly related to proximity. Distance to conduits is more important than distance to the spring. It applies to contaminant transport. It also applies to saltwater intrusion. Springs and groundwater are more vulnerable to contamination than have been predicted. There is probably a lot less water in the Florida aquifer than has been predicted. Protecting Wakaiva Springs is going to require more stringent regulation on nitrogen discharges, period. And it's very likely going to require reduced consumption of groundwater. Protecting Wakaiva by itself, if you protect the springs, I don't care if I assume everybody here cares about the springs, but you got to acknowledge that there are some people that don't. But all of us care about the access to groundwater, and access to groundwater is a freshwater resource. If you protect the springs, or if you protect some substantial subset of the springs, both in quantity and quality, you will de facto protect the Florida aquifer. Let's put it another way. That absolutely guaranteed, one by one, municipalities are going to start shifting to surface water because Florida aquifer will become not sufficient to meet the supplies. So the question is not whether you have to find an alternative source. It's the only question is when. There's two questions. When and how much are you going to have to replace? If you act now or act soon, you can probably sustain about 50% of your long-term demand for groundwater with the Florida aquifer. If you don't act at all, you're going to end up with salt water dispersed through most of the Florida, and you're going to end up with a much larger overall loss in your resource. This is how I see the problem. I just Googled some things, and I wanted to see, you know, we all use internet hits as to tell us something about what's the interest level? How many hits are on my blog? How many hits am I looking at? Global Water Resources, I got 24 million hits. That's a lot. Aquifer Protection, 1 million. Water Shortage, 8 million. Water Crisis, 27 million. Water Pollution, 34 million. Florida Springs, 40 million hits. There's a lot of people interested in Florida Springs. Florida Springs Decline, not many people know about it, 651,000. Britney Spears, 49 million hits. Free Pornography, 188 million hits. Free Sex, 366 million hits on the internet. The problem is that the degree to which we care about clean water is apparently only about 10% relative to the degree to which we care about Britney Spears. So if we don't fix this somehow, then all this other stuff is not really going to get left.